You're listening to Your Financial Choices on WDIY Allentown. Your Financial Choices may discuss various financial-related topics, and thus would like to offer the following disclosures. Lori Siebert is employed by Valley National Group, the Valley National Financial Advisors Group of Companies. Investments are offered through Valley National Investments Incorporated, member FINRA, SIPC. To ensure compliance with requirements imposed by the IRS, we inform you that any U.S. federal tax advice contained in this communication is not intended to or to be used for the purpose of avoiding penalties under the Internal Revenue Code or promoting, marketing, or recommending to another party any transaction or matter addressed herein. This show is for educational purposes only. For advice specific to your own situation, we recommend that you consult your CPA, CFP, or attorney.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. I'm a CPA, CFP, and AEP. On the web at yourfinancialchoices.com. You can listen online at wdiy.org, and shows from the past are also available there as podcast at wdiy.org. Welcome to the show. Today's December 16th, 2013. The markets were up today with record closes for the Dow and the S&P. The Dow closing at 16,167, the NASDAQ at 4070, and the S&P closed at 1810. Last week, we had guest Rod Young, CPA, CFP, to discuss year-end tax planning and multi-year planning, because you have to look at next year's planning at the same time you plan for this year. And we actually do that all year long. But I want to thank Rod for being here. He does a great job and is a frequent guest host for me. So I appreciate his involvement. Tonight, I will touch on some consumer trends in spending and credit, and then finish up some of the year-end tax planning that we covered last week, or take calls as well, questions. We are live. We are here to take your questions. Judy Ann will answer your calls, take your information, and ask you to mute your radio so you can hear me without the delay and we can talk without confusion. We do discuss general financial planning topics and not specific investments. And while I do typically have a topic each week, you can still ask questions off topic and I will do my best to answer them. The phone number is 610-758-8810. That is 610-758-8810. Email is also available at yourfinancialchoices.com. So you heard me mention that the markets were up today, and one of the reasons we think we saw that little spike was the announcement by Federal Reserve Chairman Bernanke talking about tapering of the purchasing that they are doing, that the Fed has been doing. So I'm going to talk a little bit about that. I'm not an economist, but I want to talk a little bit about that just to help kind of get our arms around what's going on with consumer spending a little bit. And the reason I wanted to talk about consumer spending is because of the holiday season, people tend to spend, and sometimes they spend more than they have. So I just want to give a little bit of a framework on that. I would prefer to take questions. So if folks had questions about tax planning, year-end tax planning, financial planning, estate planning, we can always do that. That's much more interesting to me and much more probably usable for you in your daily life. So I love taking calls and questions, but I do try to mix up the topics that we have each week. And I thought at the end of the year, December 18th, I'm just going to throw this one in. I will be gone the next 2 weeks because we have Christmas and New Year's following on a Wednesday. So I anticipate that everyone will be, you know, with their families, maybe have some background radio playing, but probably not focusing on anything I would be saying on those nights. So for the next couple of weeks, I won't be here. We will be back January 8th talking about New Year's resolutions with a PICPA representative, Alan Shannon Breslin. So that will be January 8th. So in anticipation that I'm not going to be here for a couple weeks, it's particularly important that if you do have some questions that you would like answered, you better call tonight. So the phone number is 610-758-8810. And you can be live on air or just give your question to Judy Ann and she'll bring it into the studio and I'll do the best I can to answer it. So I did a little research and a little legwork ahead and kind of typed up some of these notes from various articles that I had read. So it's going to appear that I'm reading. If it appears that I'm reading, then I am. So I just wanted to preface what I'm talking about on that, because it's just a little bit complicated. And I just kind of want to get our arms around it to set the table for our discussion, and why I think it's really important that people continue to kind of control their spending, even though we want to, just like the Fed is tapering their purchasing of treasuries and mortgage-related securities, I want people to, you know, maybe spend to help the economy, but taper that as well. Try to taper back your spending so that we don't end up in a, you know, financial crisis like we had before. So in talking about consumer trends, I think that Federal Reserve announcement affected the markets today. And what does that mean? So what that announcement means is that we have seen some positives in our economy. And so the Fed felt it was a time to, you know, taper back some of that spending. And I think that in setting the table, what I had done is I had looked at a transcript of a town hall meeting in San Francisco that was held in April by John Williams, who's the president and CEO of the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco. And you can see how we built up to what happened today with the Federal Reserve announcing this tapering. So I felt that the transcript that I looked at from Mr. Williams really kind of explained how all of this works together in a understandable way. So I'm going to look at that. So the Fed reacts to trends that they see in the economy, and the unemployment rate affects consumer spending. Consumer spending affects the profits of companies, affecting their ability to hire. And with this cycle, we add credit problems and fear of the unknown. Mr. Williams discussed in April the four factors that had slowed recovery. And the first one, he said, was the housing crash and financial crisis, which caused credit tightening. The second was the weak global economy. The third was cutbacks in state, local, and federal government spending. And the fourth was uncertainty or fear, or the fear factor. Okay, uncertainty or the fear factor. He further went on to say that while these continue to weigh on the economy, and remember he's talking in April, so he said while these four factors continue to weigh on the economy, we're seeing encouraging signs of improvement as households and financial institutions have made considerable progress in repairing their financial conditions. Okay, so we want to see progress in repairing financial condition, which again, when we talk about personal spending and credit, we want to repair that, not, you know, hinder it. Okay, he continues. The banking sector is better and credit conditions have improved. New home sales are climbing and prices are rising with fewer homeowners underwater. With rising prices, refinancing had increased, and that all was helping. Lower interest rates, more auto sales, more production, more jobs, etc. He expects the economy to grow steadily. Since 2008, the Fed bought over $3 trillion of longer-term treasuries and mortgage-related securities, and this was called quantitative easing. That's when we hear QE and QE1, like first quarter, second quarter. So QE. With what Chairman Bernanke said today was that they're going to taper that buying now from $85 billion a month to $75 billion a month. So they're not going to completely stop buying mortgage-related securities and treasuries. They're just going to taper it back. That's the tapering, meaning they're going to slow that buying down by $10 billion a month. He also discussed the federal funds rate, which is currently at 0.25%, which keeps borrowing rates down, and that they will hold that rate for some time, watching unemployment. And Bernanke indicated it could continue even past an unemployment rate of 6.5% when we're about 7% now. So one of the things that was the unknown, is that when were we going to see more tapering? We thought just a little bit lower rate, maybe to 6.5% unemployment, but they're saying that they may continue to keep these the Fed funds rate kind of down, even if it goes beyond that 6.5%. So we're going to try to get our arms around that, and then we're going to look at some consumer spending trends. We're going to take our first break. If you have questions, and it doesn't have to be about this, the phone number is 610-758-8810. Back in a minute.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including fee-based asset management. It all starts with personal goals and an understanding of risk tolerance, investment objectives, and the markets. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
Okay, and we are back. This is your host, Lori Siebert, CPA, CFP, AEP, and host of Your Financial Choices. We're talking about consumer trends and spending tonight, and I just kind of set the table, and it's all fitting together. What happened today with Chairman Bernanke's announcement of the tapering of purchasing by the Fed and continued support of the low federal funds rate, which is what, you know, sets borrowing, and some comments from the Federal Reserve Bank CEO and president of the San Francisco Fed. So he had talked back in April about what had slowed the economy down, which was the housing crash and financial crisis, which caused credit tightening, then the weak global economy, the cutbacks in government spending, and the uncertainty or the fear factor. And now we're starting to see some positive influences. So as we start to see some positive signs in, financial institutions and households in taking control of their financial conditions, now we see the Fed react, tapering their buyback of treasuries and mortgage-related securities. And so it's kind of an indication that things may be looking a little bit better. And then the markets reacted today, prices going up. But one of my concerns is when we look at how people have been spending and the cycle of spending, we just want to be careful in our continued reliance on credit. So we had seen that tightening of credit, which might have slowed credit down. People were getting better about saving, better about spending down some of their expenses. We saw some credit actually forgiven, written off the books. So some of that credit that consumers had built up was either paid off or basically written off. So we don't want those trends to continue. So my little caution about holiday spending, so be careful. So let's look at some of the spending trends. And a report from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York kind of gave some summary of that. And they said in its latest household debt and credit report, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York announced that outstanding household debt had increased $127 billion from the previous quarter, the largest increase since the first quarter of 2008. And they said the increase was due to rises in mortgage balances, student loans, auto loans, and credit card debt. This is based on data from the New York Fed's Consumer Credit Panel. And they also, though, had said this, I thought, was a good sign, which was that the percent of 90-plus day delinquent balances for all household debt had declined. So people who were running debt longer than 90 days, longer than 3 months, that had actually declined, and it was the lowest rate since the third quarter of 2008. Most household debt delinquency rates declined from the second quarter, credit card debt, mortgages, and auto loans. It said conversely, the 90-plus day delinquency rate had actually increased on home equity lines of credit and student loans. So we're seeing student loans go up. Home equity lines of credit means maybe people are taking out like extra loans off off their home equity. So we want to be careful of that as well. It had also said that 168,000 individuals had new foreclosure notations added to their credit reports. That is 70% below the peak of $556,000 individuals in the second quarter of 2009. So it looks like we're seeing foreclosures rates kind of going down. So some of those, the personal debt might be going up a little bit. They're seeing increases in that. And it could be that people are starting to feel a little bit more confident in the economy, maybe a little bit more confident in their jobs, seeing their home values going up. Maybe they're getting, you know, a little more confident, thinking they have a little bit more to spend because they could always, you know, fall back on that improvement in their home values. Maybe that's why they're tapping into those home equity lines of credit a little bit more. So it has to be a good balance of, you know, continued consumer kind of spending, feeding the economy, increasing production and jobs. But we have to be careful about how fast we start this credit spending again, because one of the I was looking at personal savings rates from, again, the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco had done a report, and they had in 1980 personal savings were at about 10.6%, and it had dropped in 2000. Personal savings as a percent of disposable income had dropped to 38% of its 1980 rate. So in 2000, we saw personal savings rate go down to 4%. So we went from 10.6 in 1980 to 4% in 2000. And then with the debacle in 2008, we saw people starting to save again, and that's why we weren't feeding the economy, and the economy wasn't doing as well. People were losing jobs. So we started seeing people starting to save more. But I think what we're starting to see now with this extra confidence is that savings rate is starting to dip again. I had printed off a report from the economic data from the St. Louis Fed. And this says Fred. I'm not sure why they call it Fred, but the personal savings rate is, as of October of 2013, it showed it to be 4.8%. So do you see the trend? I think we just want to be careful again. So the people in the Lehigh Valley who listen to Your Financial Choices, hopefully you will be the savers and not overspend. You know, there's nothing wrong with spending if you're smart about it. So one of the things we have to think about in this holiday season is looking at our discretionary spending, not our non-discretionary spending. So our discretionary spending is, you know, maybe we were eating out or, you know, buying extra things that we don't really need. Maybe we're buying wants. Well, if you want to spend for the holidays, why don't we concentrate on, you know, saving money personally to use for those gifts that we want to give to others. Don't ramp both of them up, your personal spending and your gift giving. Let's try to move the flow from your personal discretionary spending to your gifting so that you're not running up credit card debt and things like that. NerdWallet is also a credit card blog, and there was some information on there as well that we can look at. That didn't look as promising or as, encouraging as some of those other numbers that we were seeing. They were saying that the average credit card balance is about $7,000 per household, and if they look at just those households that have credit card debt, not all of us as an average, but just the households that have credit card debt, it was about $15,000. So I was surprised to see numbers that big. What I would hope is, and what this probably doesn't factor, I'm sure that is ongoing balances. You know, I strongly encourage people, if you're going to use credit cards, it's not always a bad thing. Number one, you can build up credit by showing that you pay your bills on time, and you can also get points and different things like that that you can use. But I encourage people to pay it off every month. You don't want to run those balances. So we will look at a few more numbers, and then we will talk about some tax planning. If you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810, 610-758-8810. Back in a minute.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including income tax preparation for individuals, businesses, estates, and trusts. Tax preparation involves more than putting numbers on a return. It requires planning. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
American folk and traditional music is a crazy quilt of colors and textures. In the tradition traces its many patterns and designs. Music handed down from generation to generation. In the tradition, Wednesday evening at 7 on WDIY FM Lehigh Valley Community Public Radio.
Okay, and we are back. This is your host, Lori Siebert. You're listening to Your Financial Choices. If you have questions this evening, the phone number is 610-758-8810. 610-758-8810. And I'm talking about not such a happy topic, I suppose, during the holiday season. We should be just thinking about gift giving and having fun and being, you know, generous and all of that. And here I am trying to pull the reins and pull everybody back and try to control spending. I frankly have not bought a single present yet for anyone. Well, I had a card for somebody, but I forgot it, but have not gone out and done any shopping myself. And, you know, little gift-giving ideas to control your spending. You know, one of the things I had learned when I was doing some financial planning when I first started out is I had looked at cash flow for someone and saw that they were spending $10,000 on Christmas presents. And I was like, holy moly, what are you spending $10,000 on Christmas presents for? And they proceeded to explain to me that they were buying for all the nieces and nephews and the cousins and sisters and brothers and everything. And I came up with the novel idea of draw names. And I'm kidding about it being a novel idea. I hope that people use that. When the number of people in a family get out of control, there is nothing wrong with sitting down and talking to the family and saying, you know what, does this even make sense anymore that we're buying presents for everyone? Frankly, kids nowadays, all they want is money anyway. And it almost feels a little bit less personal, you know, if we can encourage those other soft issues, getting the families together, playing Yahtzee, playing games, apples to apples, having nice dinners. There are more memories made in that than the presents that are under the tree or that are not under the tree, but in an envelope because they're getting cash or gift cards. And with my family, I'm from a large family, my husband's from a large family, and many, many years ago when we all started having children, we all agreed that we would not buy exchange presents for siblings any longer, and it was really almost even too much for cousins to all exchange presents or buy for all of the nieces and nephews. And so what we did is the cousins draw names. So all the cousins draw names and we have one cousin buy for one other cousin. And then we put a dollar limit on it. We'll say, you know, $30 at the most. And then with my siblings, at one point we were drawing names and then we also stopped that. We're buying for the nieces and nephews, which are much fewer on my side of the family. But for the adults, it got a little depressing then because there were no presents for the adults. So what we decided to do several years ago was something called a white elephant. People may be familiar with that. And it could be that, you know, a white elephant sometimes would be that you bring something that you no longer need or it's used or whatever. We actually call it a white elephant, but we do put a dollar limit on it, and people can buy a gift if they want, but we have limited it. So we say about $30, and it's only one gift. So we each come with one gift that's $30, and then we all draw a number, and it's, you know, the first person gets to pick the first present, the second person gets to pick a present, and then if they liked the first person's better, they can exchange it. And that's how that game works, and you go all the way through. And then when we get to the last person, the folks who had number one can actually take the last gift. And it ends up being a lot of fun. And, you know, we just get crazy sometimes. And it's really funny when we find out that we're all secretly buying a present that my mother could use. And that in the end, we quite often will leave many of the presents for my mom. And that's a lot of fun as well. So one year, I think she got three frying pans. So you want to try to get clever this time of year in your spending habits and what you're doing, and just be a little bit smarter maybe about what we're doing. And it's not, you know, that good of a feeling after the holidays when you start getting those credit card bills and all of a sudden, you know, you're having stress around having to pay for it, etc. What happened with this Nerd Wallet, they had some comments about these credit card balances that I had mentioned, and then they talked about some trends that it looked like indebtedness had fallen, and this is where they had said that we'd like to think it was because newly frugal Americans paid off their credit card balances, but however, a number of not-so-pleasant factors contributed to the decline. They said in 2010, credit card companies wrote off seriously delinquent debts in earnest, lowering the total amount of revolving credit card debt. In the charge-off rate, the percentage of dollars owed that issuers have written off as uncollectible rose to 10.9% in the second quarter of 2010. So some folks might have it in their head, though, I can go charge and I'll just let the credit card company write it off. Well, you have to understand sometimes when you have debts written off, it could be income to you. And now what you thought was written off and wasn't the credit card company really nice to forgive you that debt, well, now they're going to issue a tax document and all of a sudden you're going, what's this tax document? Well, guess what? You might have to report that on your tax return as income. So you're not totally off the hook. There are some exceptions around that when you might not have to report it as income. It all depends on if you are insolvent or not, and then there might be a couple other exemptions. But insolvency basically means that your debts exceed the fair market value of your assets, your home and retirement accounts, etc. Well, you might think you don't have any assets, but if you have a retirement account and that gets included in that calculation, all of a sudden what you thought might not be taxable to you ends up being taxable. So you don't want to take that route. The other thing, it affects your credit. And when your credit is affected, you have a credit score that's affected. That credit score affects your ability to take out a mortgage, the rates that they'll be charged. You know, the people who have good credit will qualify for a better interest rate on that mortgage. So you don't want to have a spiral of problems where you dig yourself into a hole and you miss out on all the opportunities that other people who have good credit get. And, you know, that's how people get ahead. They have better rates available to them by being good consumers and paying off their credit card bills and paying off their mortgage payments. So you don't want to have a negative credit score. That also can affect sometimes your ability to get a rental, you know, get into an apartment. So rental properties managers can check your credit nowadays, and they do. You know, in the past, there might have been times where you'd go and get an apartment and maybe no one was checking it, or we didn't even realize they were checking it, but they do look at these things now and how good you are at making your payments. So it's just not a good habit to get into thinking that someone's going to pay for your bills when you couldn't, if you're not being smart about how you're spending. So take those steps to do that during this holiday season. Folks, if you have questions this evening, we can do some last-minute tax planning or tax questions folks have. Some people are already getting ready for next year's tax season. I've had some people call and email me asking what they need to do to get their records in order, or if possibly they need to do a fourth quarter estimated tax payment. If you're someone who does estimated tax payments, do you have to do one? Maybe you don't want to have penalties and interest. So what do you need to pay attention to avoid that? One of the ways is to make a fourth quarter estimated tax payment. Maybe even if you do owe extra money, maybe you don't have to make that estimated tax payment. How do you have a safe harbor to avoid penalties and interest? If you have questions this evening, the phone number is 610-758-8810. Back in a minute.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including estate planning and tax preparation, especially for Pennsylvania and New Jersey residents subject to state inheritance tax reporting. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
And you are listening to WDIY Allentown, 88.1 FM and WDIY.org, serving the Lehigh Valley. The time now is 6:30. Now back to your financial choices with our host, Lori Siebert.
Thank you, Jeff. Welcome back to the show, folks. Feeling a little lonely out here. If anyone has questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. I will get off that topic of consumer spending and trends. It's obviously a very depressing topic. It's not spurring any phone calls. I will mention, you know, a long time ago when I first started doing tax returns, we could get a deduction on our tax returns if we itemized deductions for personal interest, student loan interest, all kinds of things. I think credit card debt. And I think it was in 1986, maybe, I think in the Reagan years, actually, there was a change. And we are not allowed to deduct what we call personal interest anymore. So personal interest being auto loan interest. There's some exceptions for student loans now, and I think that might even be expiring this year, if I'm not mistaken. I'd have to go look that one up. But credit card debt, definitely not. So personal interest for individuals, we cannot take a deduction for that. So that was another reason why, you know, you don't want to rack up credit cards, because you don't get a deduction for that interest, especially when you're looking at credit card interest payments of about 25% or so. Some are lower. Some people might still be getting those envelopes and offers in the mail for 0% financing. You know, that would be certainly something to look at if you're someone who has a credit card balance that you can't seem to get out from under, and you're continuing to have higher interest rates on those credit cards. If you do have those kinds of offers, I would suggest you might try to take advantage of that. You just have to be real careful of the disclosures and the language. You want to make sure that you're not going to get hit. What happens is, if you go with those 0% credit cards, what sometimes happens is in the fine print, they'll say if you miss a payment or you're late for a payment, the rate will go back up to like 25%, and then there might be penalties. There was all kinds of new rules in 2010 around credit cards. I'm not going to go into those tonight, but it might be something to pay attention to, especially if that lower interest rate would allow you to be able to make those payments by lowering the amount due, because now we have a lower interest rate. So watch out for that as well. So no deduction for that. I was talking right before the break about, let's talk about tax planning for a little bit, any last minute tax planning. So if folks have questions this evening, we can certainly do that. Talk about harvesting losses, capital losses if you need them. I'll talk about when not to do that in just a minute. But if you do have questions, we can move from that taboo topic and talk about something a little bit more exciting and a little bit more applicable, maybe, or, you know, talk friendly. So the phone number is 610-758-8810. I had a call come in. We had Ken from Whitehall, and he said he's interested in my take on wealth management for retirees by buying permanent insurance. What do you think of that as an investment? Well, Ken, I think what you are talking about when we talk about permanent insurance is whole life, possibly. I am not insurance licensed, so I want to give that disclosure there. And as far as retirees, you know, I think that you need to look at the whole picture. I'm not sure if this topic has come up in conversation, because possibly a financial advisor that you might be talking to might sell insurance. You want to make sure that whomever you are talking to for guidance, what their background is, what the bulk of their business is there full disclosure, Are they working under a fiduciary capacity, a fiduciary capacity, meaning they're acting in the best interest of you, the client? When you look at wealth management, one of the things that people will sometimes talk about when they look at whole life insurance policies is that you could build up like a cash value in them. And what happens is, how it will be explained is that you can build up this value and there's no tax consequence on it at this point. So if you have an investment that you're building up returns on, you have to pay income tax on interest and dividends and things like that. So the idea is, if you put something in, this is my my general comments on this. So you put something in an insurance policy and you build up this value, but you're not having to pay income tax on it. So there's a bit of like a concept of like a deferral there. And so how I think these have been sometimes pitched is that in the event that you need that money, if you had it in a brokerage account and you had to take it out, you might have gains on, you know, a sale to get money out. In a insurance policy, you can borrow from it. What you have to be careful of, though, is the original investment in those kinds of contracts, you know, usually pays a commission to that person selling it. And you're not necessarily building up value at that point, but you're kind of locked in and tied in. And then if you eventually borrow from that policy, there would be an interest rate applicable to that. And I have seen where sometimes people have borrowed from policies, and then when they want to let those policies go, there's actually a tax consequence, a taxable event, and sometimes they're not small taxable events. So you just want to be really careful, Ken, when you're looking at this as an option. I think that from a financial advising standpoint, there are a lot of different tools that a financial advisor can use, and a lot of different tools that we may find appropriate for any number of individuals. So I'm not saying that it wouldn't be appropriate for some people, but I would just say you have to be very careful. A lot of times what we find is people, as they're in their retirement years, they don't need life insurance. We usually see people buying life insurance when they have a family, they may have a mortgage, they may have kids with school coming up, tuition expectations. So they want to make sure if anything happens to them that they've provided for their family or loved ones that they're going to leave behind to cover those expenses that otherwise would have been paid from me, a working parent or spouse. So that is a big need that we have for insurance. So I definitely think people have to look at insurance for risk management. It's just what kind of insurance you want to look at and what's appropriate for you. So kind of a long answer, Ken, but I hope that it kind of gives you just some kind of guidance and general understanding so that you can ask the right questions and see if there are other alternatives for you that may make sense. You didn't really say what your need might be there. So I equated that it was pitched to you maybe as some kind of a wealth management technique. And that's where I would kind of say, you want to look at that a little bit more carefully. Okay, I appreciate the call. If you have questions this evening, the phone number is 610-758-8810. That's 610-758-8810. I mentioned a couple items when we look at year-end tax planning. And one was estimated income tax payments for the fourth quarter, which are due in January. Some people ask if they can pay them in December. I'll talk about that in a minute, because the one thing I definitely want to talk about before year end and before the end of the show, to make sure I get this out there, is quite often you'll hear financial advisors talk to their clients about harvesting tax losses as if everyone has to do that and we all have to do it before year end. Keep in mind that that could impact you in a way that we can't always predict, because if everybody is harvesting tax losses at the end of the year, what is that doing, you know, to the market? Now, right now, today, the market's up, you know, huge high. Maybe people don't even have losses. I don't know. But if you have had some realized gains during the year and you're in a very high tax bracket, you certainly could be a candidate for harvesting losses. If you are someone who makes married filing joint over $250,000 a year or single making over $200,000 a year, there is an extra tax that will be applied to you called the net investment income tax, and it is 3.8% on your net investment income that exceeds $250,000. It's the lower of the amount that it exceeds it or the net investment income itself. So there's that extra 3.8% tax on that. So if you are someone who has $25,000 of capital gains and you're going to be subject to this net investment income tax, you certainly might be someone who would want to look in your portfolio to see if there are any losses that you could take to offset some of those gains. And then that would lower that additional 3.8% tax. It also would make sense for folks who are making over $400,000 a year, I believe married filing joint, because you're going to be in a 39.6% tax bracket on your incremental income over that amount. For those people, their capital gains tax rate is not 15%, it's 20%. So there again, it might make sense for you to harvest tax losses if they're available in your portfolio. But for some of you who are in a, 25% tax bracket and your capital gains are 15%, maybe that's all right. Maybe it doesn't matter. Maybe you're not subject to the net investment income. Maybe you don't need to take those losses. So you want to decide, is it worth it to avoid a 15% tax? If there's any other reason, just got distracted for a moment. If you're in a 15% tax bracket, ordinary income tax bracket, and you have capital gains, those capital gains are going to be taxed at 0%. So why would you want to harvest losses to offset something that's going to get taxed at zero? So when you're looking at your own situation and you have someone who's telling you what to do, if they don't know what your tax situation is, you really need to kind of step up and say, you know what, it doesn't make sense for me to take those losses because I'm in a 0% tax bracket. So don't pay attention to blanket statements, blanket observations, and blanket craziness of everyone around you or, on television saying, oh, we've got to, harvest losses to offset our gains. It might not apply to you. So just keep that in mind. I had a call from David in Easton, and I'll see if I can cover this before the end of before our next break. And he says he has a Subchapter S corporation. Until now, he has been taking the profits as such. He was given advice to pay himself on payroll. His accountant says he can set something up as a business income and not do a payroll. He is confused by these options. What is best? David, what happens with an S corporation? In an S corporation, some folks can set up as a business entity. You can do a business entity as a Schedule C sole proprietor. You may have a partner, then you could do a partnership, or you could do an S corporation, and an S corporation could be either one shareholder, yourself, or a number of shareholders. So there's different ways to run a business. What was happening for many years, David, was people were setting up S corporations. Oh, let me back up for a second. Sole proprietor, Schedule C, you have income, and you pay a self-employment tax, which is Social Security tax, on your profit. That's a Schedule C sole proprietor. You just pay the Social Security tax on your profit. You pay your income tax. A partnership, they file a tax return. They pass the profits out to the partners. The partners report the income as self-employment income, just like my sole proprietor. And the partnership partners pay self-employment tax, okay, on all their income. S corporation typically will have an employee and pay wages. You get a W-2. The employer pays the Social Security tax on that, and then any additional profits, leftover profits, flow through to the shareholder And then you report that as just, you know, kind of other income on your return. And that other income is not subject to self-employment tax. So what was happening is a lot of folks were trying to set up S corporations to avoid the Social Security or self-employment tax. So the IRS a few years ago started really looking at S corporations, and they're continuing to look at S corporations. So if we see someone who is pushing all the income through to page one and not subjecting it to the self-employment tax, that's a huge flag, and the IRS could come down. I'll continue the discussion, though, David, so stay tuned. I'm up for a break, and when I come back, I'll finish that up. Phone number 610-758-8810. Back in a minute.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services including portfolio management, tax return preparation, and financial planning for the accumulation years, retirement years, and estate distribution. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
And you are listening to WDIY, Lehigh Valley's community NPR station, your source for NPR news, public affairs, and a great mix of hand-picked music. The time now is 6:46. Now back to our program.
Thank you, Jeff. So, David, the continued conversation about the S corporation. So I think what your accountant is saying, and I personally do not do S corporations, but what your accountant is saying is, versus having to do a W-2 and payroll, he can treat some of the income like a guaranteed payment, and then that would flow through on your K-1 as like self-employment income, similar to what we would have for that partnership, and then you would have the self-employment tax on that part of it. And what the IRS is looking for on S corporations, especially when they're like a sole shareholder, is reasonable compensation. So if you have an S corporation and you're doing consulting income, like a recruiter, and the average salary of a recruiter, and I'm making these numbers up, is $80,000. And you're doing that, and you happen to have a super great year, and you got some extra commissions for, you know, pulling off some great, you know, job placement, and you made $120,000, what your S-Corp would look like is your $80,000 would be your wages or your earned income that would pass through as self-employment income, subject to those extra taxes. And then the $40,000, the other amount, would be just like a profit, like other income, and not subject to the self-employment tax. So that's what you need to look at and work with your accountant on, is what would be deemed a reasonable compensation for your S-corporation business. If it's reasonable, the IRS isn't going to have a problem with it. And then, I'm making some general comments, but the excess would be not subject to that self-employment tax. So I hope that makes sense. Good luck. I think it's smart. We should have been talking about this years ago, probably. I don't like letting clients do anything that I couldn't argue in front of the IRS. So thank you for the call. I hope that helped. Phil from Bethlehem has two questions. He said he worked with a tax prep person last year and they made a mistake. A long-term tax loss was listed in short-term. How do we correct? Well, if it was listed in short-term, Phil, and you didn't have any other short-term gains, it shouldn't have mattered because losses will offset either short or long. Where it would have been a problem was if you had a lot of short-term gains. So pretend you had $100,000 of short-term gains and you had $50,000 of long-term gains, but also $50,000 of long-term losses. Your long-term loss has to offset your long-term gains first, and to the extent your long-term losses are more than offset, then you can use it against short-term and vice versa. So if in this case you used a long-term loss against short-term gains and you actually had long-term gains, then what could have happened is you could have understated your short-term gains. Short-term gains are taxed at ordinary income tax rates. So that's where you could run into a little problem. So either this is going to have some impact, little impact, or no impact, all depends on your gains in each of those categories. All right, so how do you correct it? You file an amended tax return. It's very easy, a 1040X. You pull in the information as the return was originally filed, make the corrections, and then the newly filed return will show the differences and what the bottom line impact is. If you had a tax preparer do it last year for you and you let them know that it was a mistake, if it was their mistake, then I would expect that they would file that amended return at no charge to you. So you just want to make sure it's, you know, you look it over and it's still accurate. If the mistake was yours, then I would expect that you would have to pay someone to file that amended return for you. And it is a 1040X, and you know, you go through all the calculations and see what you owe or how it works out. So good luck with that. You had asked a second question. What is the best way to hire a new person to work on his tax return, qualifications, etc.? Well, when you need to find someone to help you prepare your tax returns, one way is to look on the Pennsylvania Institute of Certified Public Accountants website, the PICPA. Their website might be PICPA.org. I'm a member of the PICPA, and I believe you can possibly find an accountant through that website. You know, I'm a CPA, so typically, you know, I would probably say go with a CPA, but you don't have to. Some people have fairly easy tax returns. I have no problem if people have really easy tax returns, you know, them using software and doing it themselves. Or sometimes we have elderly people who use different organizations around the community that might have volunteers helping with preparing the tax return. I've seen some of those folks make mistakes, and, you know, we end up correcting them, and that sometimes happens. But even CPAs can make mistakes. So you want to make sure that you're working in tandem with a good preparer who's listening to you, asking questions, maybe giving you a questionnaire, actually looking at your return and kind of analyzing it a little bit. Sometimes people can do IRA contributions that will lower their income, which might give them more deductions, which might give them, you know, other credits. So you want someone who's not just quickly inputting data. You want someone to make sure, you want to work with someone who's, you know, kind of looking at that information and making sure that they're not being aggressive in any positions. I'm not into being aggressive on positions. You just want to make sure that you're getting strategies and tax advantages as they're available to you and allowed. So good luck with that. Those are my suggestions. I do like CPAs. I mean, the other thing, Phil, what's happening with CPAs is the IRS has, and did I say this at the top of the show? I'm not sure. No, I think I had mentioned this to a client before I left work tonight. The IRS has fewer and fewer and fewer agents helping them. So what they are doing is raising the liability of CPAs. And our liability is getting higher and higher. So one of the, and the consequences of that, big fines that CPAs can have, fines for not asking if you have foreign income, foreign bank accounts, the disclosures around that. So with that, accountants are having to do, you know, some extra, you know, legwork, extra questionnaires, and that type of thing. But with that, sometimes comes a discovery of information that will help people in the preparation of their return and taking advantage of some of those things. So as we have that higher scrutiny and expectation from the IRS, it also is, I feel, making sure that we're asking enough questions that we can hit on a lot of points on your tax return, like education credits, student loans, retirement contributions, Schedule A itemized deductions. So if we're having to ask more of those questions, then I think it only helps the tax payer more. sometimes it doesn't go that way. Sometimes we discover income that you weren't reporting, and then, you know, that could be a little problem, like my little call earlier from David with the S Corporation. Sometimes it might cost you more. But you got to remember, sometimes in costing you more, in that example in particular, when you have someone paying in to Social Security on their earnings and income, they're actually building up their Social Security record and their future retirement payments from Social Security, but they're also could be building up a disability record as well, that if they end up being disabled, they actually have something that they might collect on. You'd be surprised how many self-employed people I have seen that their Social Security benefit is so low, and it's probably from years of, you know, very low earnings from their self-employment. So, you know, keep that all in mind. So we talked about taking capital losses. It might not apply to you, so make sure that you understand when it might or when it might not, and when it's to your advantage or not. I never like seeing people take capital losses when they're in a 0% tax bracket. I like them to save those losses if they could use them in future years, maybe when they have more income, higher income, ordinary rates that are higher, that they could use capital losses first to offset other gains and then to offset $3,000 of ordinary income on page one. So that's my comment on that. As far as the quarterly payments, because I only have a couple minutes left here, for folks who make estimated tax payments and for people who may not make estimated tax payments, let's say you're someone who does not make estimated tax payments, what happens is the IRS says we are a pay-as-you-go system. Pay as you go. So if you're earning money, whether it's wages, interest, dividends, IRA payments, pension payments, Social Security, other income, maybe gambling money, self-employment income, it's a pay as you go system. So they expect if you're earning taxable money and you're going to owe tax, they're expecting that you're going to pay it as you go. If you have wages, typically our employer withholds the federal wages for us, and we may cover our tax due through those withholdings. If we take IRA distributions or pension payments, we may ask those trustees or custodians of those plans to withhold federal tax for us. And if they do, we may cover our tax due through those kinds of federal withholdings. If we're someone who makes earned income, has wages, and we only have enough withheld to cover our wages, but we also have a great investment portfolio and we make another $20,000 in interest or dividends or capital gains, if my withholdings from my work have not covered that tax in full, then I need to make quarterly estimated tax payments for the tax that is on that other earned income. If I wanted, I could increase my withholdings at work, and that could cover those payments, and then I could avoid estimated tax payments completely. And in fact, the IRS deems withholdings to be made evenly throughout the year. So if I screwed up and forgot to tell my employer to withhold extra tax to cover all my investment income tax, I could ask my employer in my December payroll, hey, withhold an extra $3,000, and my employer, if I've done it timely, could withhold that extra money. The IRS will deem me to have paid that throughout the year, and I will have my safe harbor. I will have paid in enough tax. That's a safe harbor. You pay in as much as you think you're going to owe. If you do it through withholding, it's deemed to be evenly throughout the year. If I forget to do that, and I have this going on every year, and I keep forgetting to make those estimated tax payments, the IRS is going to charge us a penalty and interest for underpayment of tax. One of the things I can do is do those quarterly payments. If I forget to do the quarterly payments, I can try to make it up a little bit. We still have January 15th to make up. That would abate it a little bit. But again, if we've done it in the fourth quarter, the IRS says that was not done evenly throughout the year. We're going to be a little under. We might still have a little bit of a penalty. If we have all the income in the last quarter, there's something called the annualization method that we can apply to get us out of some of those penalties. But basically, folks, it's a pay-as-you-go system. You want to make sure you have certain safe harbors, either pay in as much as you owe in the current year or as much as you owed in the prior year. There's some other ones, but I don't have time to go into those. I want to mention again that we will be off the next 2 weeks. We'll be back on January 8th to discuss New Year's resolutions, where I'm going to have a guest from the PICPA representing the PICPA, Alan Shannon Breslin. I want you to get started on early on those New Year's resolutions. I want to say happy holidays and happy New Year to everyone. Happy New Year, Jeff. My best to all of you. Thank you, listeners. Thank you, callers, tonight for calling in the questions. You were my lifesaver because I was running out of things to talk about. Thank you, Judy Ann. Stay tuned for In the Tradition Folk Music with Tom Druckenmiller. Remember, pay attention, be proactive, not reactive. Make the best of your financial choices and have a great week.